The following podcast is a live recording of a radio show, first broadcast by Fresh FM, with the assistance from New Zealand On Air.
Kia ora everybody and welcome to today's hybrid episode of Climate Matters. I'm Lindsay Wood. I'm the Director of Climate Strategy Company Resilience Limited, and Climate Matters is brought to you by Fresh FM, the top of the South Community Access radio station. And a special welcome to new listeners in the Waikato and Hamilton on Free FM, and also, of course, to our listeners in the Canterbury region and Christchurch on Plains Media, and to Arrow FM listeners in the Wairarapa. Anyway, I said today's is a bit of a hybrid episode because we happen to have an interview, first of all, with Professor Colin Butler from the Australian National University. But then we've also got enough time for me to give you a little bit of a snapshot on the actual other items that went out with Climate Matters number 162. So apologies, the numbers are getting a little bit jumbled. That seems to be the name of the game on Interviews Weekly and Climate Matters Fortnightly and all of that. So here's what we'll be covering. First of all, in the interview with Colin Butler, and Colin is a professor whose skills span poverty, epidemiology, climate disaster recovery, health in heat, and various other things. So he'll be talking a bit about low-income communities. He has a metaphor called the iron fist in the embroidered glove. He has quite a bit to say about official hypocrisy on supporting poorer communities and the need for sincerity in attempts to elevate low incomes. Talks about the myth of the cornucopian enchantment, the risk of very selective mainstream media and of social media misinformation, the challenge of us actually getting to understand the climate change problem. He touches base on carbon tax in Australia, on vested interests obstructing progress, and fear and hope. So including a military apprehension of what is coming. So that's a fair bit from Colin Butler, but we will have time for a few items, as I mentioned, from Substack 152, including community fridge networks, same nitrogen plot, but different actors, Kiwis in climate book. I've mentioned that briefly before. Nicola Willis, our Minister of Finance, earns herself a goon gong. The Climate Change Commission's National Climate Risk Assessment, a hotter tip for a cooler planet. And finally, a quest for Anthropocene intelligence in university education. I hope we have time for all of those. But first of all, let's get into the interview with Professor Colin Butler. It's a special honour and a real pleasure to have as our guest today Colin Butler, who's an honorary professor at the National Centre for Epidemiology and Population Health and the Institute for Climate, Energy and Disaster Solutions at the Australian National University, as well as having several other university positions. Colin has authored over 200 papers, edited or co-edited 4 books, and held many distinguished roles. And in 2014, one particular distinguished role was becoming, and I quote, the first health contributor to the IPCC to be arrested for civil disobedience over climate change, in this case, for protesting Australian coal exports. And still quoting, I believe that climate change is the greatest moral issue of our time, yet it is only one of a suite of interacting threats to global public health. I salute you for that, Colin, as well as welcome you most warmly to the show.
Thank you so much, Lindsay, for reaching out.
Well, I'd like to invite you to guide our discussion, but I want to give you a bit of a wide segue into that by referencing one of your many publications. As well as being lead editor of the authoritative book, Climate Change and Global Health, Primary, Secondary and Tertiary Effects, you also authored or co-authored 18 out of its 40 chapters. And as if that wasn't enough, the content of those chapters ranges hugely, such as from inequality, to regional climate impacts on health, to occupational heat effects, to the links between climate change, migration, and health. So I'll be fascinated to learn where you take us from here, Colin.
I really wanted to have deep conversations. Topics such as the limits to growth or human carrying capacity or population growth rates in low-income settings.
When we translate issues like health in low-income countries, and I see Australia and New Zealand as broadly not low-income countries, I then think, what should countries like Australia or New Zealand do in the policy space to better look after the lower-income communities? And certainly in New Zealand, the Pacific Islands.
Well, I don't know so much about the Pacific Islands specifically. I think there's such a difference between stated policy and real policy. I sometimes think governments have this iron fist inside this beautiful embroidered glove, and we point to the glove and ignore the fist. Even back in 1949, President Truman, in his inaugural speech, he made these claims that America, from now on, would try to give more opportunities to low-income countries to create a fairer world. And there's been this rhetoric going on, you know, all of my life. And I went to Africa as a medical student in 1985. I spent a year in low-income settings. I was, in a way, motivated by the idealism of a fairer world. And for a while there, I believed it, and all the rhetoric of the UN and so on. And then I went for a period of thinking, well, look, there's good forces and bad forces, but there's still a struggle. Now, I think that iron fist is increasingly emerging from the glove. And we see that most clearly with the US president, and, you know, his complete withdrawal of, or almost complete withdrawal of foreign aid and so on. Lester Pearson, the Canadian prime minister who got the Nobel Peace Prize, he had this commission in the late 1960s. He said, all rich countries should try and give 0.7% of their GDP to promote development. And I used to think, well, Pearson might have been sincere, and other people around him might have been sincere, but collectively, this has not actually been followed at all. And now it's getting worse.
Is 0.7% of GDP a sort of the right sort of number? I know you can't be exact about it, but is that in the right zone?
I don't know. No one's ever asked me that before. I think what's the most important thing is sincerity in the attempt to elevate incomes in low-income settings. And I don't think enough people are sincere at all. In my PhD, I coined this term, the cornucopian enchantment. And that was the idea that we can have it all. We can have a cornucopian enchantment. We don't have to respond to inequality, because market forces and new technology are going to lift everyone out of poverty. It suits those with power to pretend this happening. Just at the moment, I've got to give a keynote talk. I looked this morning at Twitter, and there's a post on Twitter posted yesterday, which is supposed to have already had 56,000 views. And it says, it's headlined something like, 26 IPCC authors reject IPCC report findings. Then I looked into it deeper. These so-called 26 scientists, they all made these comments, or most of them, 20 or 30 years ago. And yet the tweet is presented as breaking news, and it's got tens of thousands of views. And I can respond, but so what? Nobody pays any attention. So there is this incredible tension. The idea that humans can affect the whole Earth system, it's a great cognitive challenge to our, you know, primate brains. Rivals heliocentrism, the Earth goes around the sun and not the other way around. These things took some time to get through. And I'm thinking, well, it's not just this one person who made the tweet, it's also all the people who gullibly accept it. What is going on there? I mean, how long did it take for us to accept that the Earth's not flat or that we go around the sun? Maybe it took probably generations, and maybe with climate change it's similar, and yet we don't actually have time to really find out.
In the intro, I quoted you as saying I believe that climate change is the greatest moral issue of our time, yet it is only one of a suite of interacting threats to global public health. Can you unpick that for us some more, and including point to how it might manifest itself in good climate policy?
I clearly remember Kevin Rudd, the Australian Prime Minister at the time in 2007, said this. Yeah. But I mean, this is back to the embroidered glove and the iron fist. And I don't know if Rudd sincerely believed it, but certainly in 2007, he could get political points in Australia for saying that and help win the election. And then he went to the Copenhagen meeting in 2009, and it became clear that the big players in the room were going to drop climate change, and Rudd he came back and Rudd dropped it as well. And I think there's so many examples like this, and I do fear that we're heading for maybe a piecemeal or a staggered collapse of civilization.
I'd like to come to that in a minute, but I just wondered if you had any policy pointers around the question of it being the biggest moral issue of our time.
I guess a carbon tax is a policy prescription, and we had a kind of carbon tax in Australia under the Gillard government, and it actually worked very well. If you put the price up and collect more money, well, you could redistribute to the poor. But actually, this is back to the embroidered glove thing, that we actually don't do it.
The embroidered glove analogy is an interesting one, and I'm, if I'm interpreting you the right way, it is rather saying that we're making it look like we're doing good things for people who need good things doing, but really and truly it's a self-centred.
Completely self-centred, and it's such a painful thing to recognise that hardly anyone will look at it.
If you had a magic climate strategy wand or climate policy wand, and you could conjure up one policy, does you have anything in front of mind?
Well, I'd definitely put in a carbon tax. But again, you've got these immense resources opposed to it. And the fossil fuel industry and other people, you know, the earth system depleters, they've got us, they've got an iron grip around us.
For me, it seems to me that humanity is experiencing the climate crisis the way Ernest Hemingway described firms going bankrupt, gradually and then suddenly. Do you feel we should approach the question of time in terms of the climate crisis?
I've been looking back at the precursors of the limits to growth, and Shoemaker had a chapter called The Economics of Permanence, and the idea actually, there was a book with a similar title in the 1940s. So obviously we should be looking into the deep future as policymakers, and yet they have really dropped the ball. We need to have fear to do something, but we also need to have hope, because without the hope we become paralysed. But clearly, you know, pain and hunger and so on have evolved to get us to do something. We weren't hungry, we wouldn't eat, we'd starve. We didn't have pain, we wouldn't learn. We definitely need to have fear, but too much of it is paralysing. So how do you get the right dose? I've been writing, thinking about this for years. You know, we are still seduced by that cornucopian enchantment. And of course, the other, you know, dimension of the wicked problem of climate change is it's always in the future. It's a really hard sell. So can we get sort of technological rescue at the last minute? It's got to be somehow or other an order of magnitude cheaper than the current renewables, with less of an ecological footprint. And yet at the same time, we're building all these data centres, and people like Sam Altman are claiming that artificial intelligence is going to solve climate change. To me, this is all part of this sort of this muddled collective thinking. The other thing that's going to happen is serious attempts at geoengineering, which are very likely going to go wrong. Back in 2012, I went to a meeting in Lancaster House, which had six representatives of 60 countries. It was, I don't know how many people. There were only three academics. Everyone else was a general or something. I met some really nice people. I heard the talks. I felt that the senior military can see what's coming, and they live in fear that they're going to have to go out and do horrible things. and they want to stop it, and they're trying to recruit civil society and people like David Spratt and for that matter myself. And yet we are ultimately absolutely powerless.
In the book that you co-authored, in the final chapter of Climate Change and Global Health, you wrote a chapter with the evocative title, Developing a Social Vaccine to Motivate Transformation. Please give us some insights as to what a social vaccine is and what we might look forward to in the future.
With a literal, because I'm a medical doctor originally, with a literal vaccination, you get a small dose of the poison or the so-called the antigen. You're getting, like, we have a smallpox vaccination. You're getting a little bit of it. You might get a blister, but you won't get the full disease. So it's so basically good things come out of a dose of poison, a small dose of poisons. We right. need a small dose of fear, or anxiety, or even panic to do anything. But too much is completely paralyzing. But we don't want to live just in a fantasy or back in the cornucopian enchantment. We do nothing and we'll be fine because market forces will rescue us. Well, they won't.
So how would that dose of fear best be administered, Colin? I want to take it seriously and think, okay, if we had a strategy there, how would we go about implementing it?
Well, through an open debate, more talking. The book is also dedicated to Maurice King, who was an early mentor of mine who's also passed away. Maurice had this idea of benign uproar. He wanted to encourage discussion about difficult topics. So right. there could be uproar in that discussion room, but it wouldn't be malignant. So Maurice worked and lived in Africa for a long time. He warned of things like the Rwandan genocide. That's an example of malignant uproar, people fighting and killing.
Right.
He said, let's liberate these uncomfortable ideas and discuss them, maybe in your citizens' assemblies and so on. And it might, let's be franker about the dark possibilities rather than suppressing them or ignoring them or tabooing them.
And in a way, these discussions are a recurring theme. A recent interviewee on the same Front Footing the Future series was Professor Jonathan Boston, a professor of policy at University of Wellington. And he was advocating very strongly the importance of good discussion in the community.
I do wish there was more conversations like this, more of that but benign uproar, more. I think the media is so controlled. James Hansen, who I admire as, really the one of the leading, if not the leading climate scientist of our time, he complains that how the media just selects the same few. Why is that?
Well, that's an insightful, if rather troubling, note on which we'll draw this interview to a close. Colin, I do want to thank you so much for making time for this. You're in Taiwan. You've got a presentation to give on Monday. And so I've greatly enjoyed our discussion. Thank you very much for your time and good luck with your presentation.
You're extremely welcome. Thank you so much.
Well, Colin took us into all sorts of places that I didn't expect, but wasn't he interesting? And now we've got about 5 minutes left just to do a quick snapshot of the other items in Climate Matters, number 152. So here we go. How cool to be cool, a movement of its time. And this is based on an article on the Baltimore Community Fridge Network, which apparently is one of many such networks in the States. It comes with a map that shows a whole lot, probably 20 or 30 different locations on an app. Their tagline is fighting food insecurity, one fridge at a time. That's pretty cool. There'll be a link to the article, of course. Baltimore reports on all four, but for us in New Zealand, unfortunately familiar, 28% of families dealing with food insecurity. Much the same numbers here. They may even be higher here. The way the fridges work, locals adopt them, keep tabs on them. They check they're clean and tidy. Of course, there needs to be a power supply and some arrangements for payment. To give you an idea, my fridge, if I'm running it off the mains on the grid, runs at about 2 cents an hour. That's about 50 cents a day. And the whole community fridge system operates a little bit like those community book swaps we know, where people come and put food in or take food out or whatever. And often they're actually located beside book swaps. That makes good sense, doesn't it? And what's the climate connection, you may be asking? Well, food waste causes some 10% of global warming. So it's quite a big deal, and reducing waste is a great climate action. But additionally, addressing poverty and malnutrition means healthier people who are better able to make positive contributions to society. Now, I'm going to give quite a big quote here. It's based in France. When Petit got out of hospital, he learned that his horse had been sent for incineration by the town hall. He feared crucial evidence might be lost, yet as it happened, the incineration service was on strike that day. Petit got his horse's body back and arranged an autopsy privately. The results changed everything. The horse's lungs contained lethal amounts of hydrogen sulfide. I'm quoting to a long lead in The Guardian, which we will link to. What's that all about? It's about the same, only different, a familiar nitrogen plot, different actors. Basically, the beaches in Brittany and France have endured decades of toxic hydrogen sulfide gas caused from rotting seaweed, which has bloomed in the area thanks to nitrogen runoff from intensive agriculture. The victims and the professionals who understood what was happening were systemically blocked and undermined or sidelined by politicians, by officialdom, and by vested interests. And if you listen to our Front Footing the Future interview with Dr. Mike Joy, well, in fact, when this is broadcast, you will have listened to it. You'll find alarming parallels between Brittany beaches and the Canterbury Plains. For toxic gas from seaweed in France, read contaminated drinking water in New Zealand. For hydrogen sulfide poisoning in France, read colorectal cancer in Canterbury. For the pig industry, read the dairy industry. And there's a whole lot more about the way this came about, which has all sorts of parallels. We'll give a link to that Guardian article, plus to an explainer on how high nitrogen fertilizers change the food system and so on. Okay, I mentioned briefly the important wide-ranging book from Kiwis in Climate. Kiwis in Climate is a great organization founded by John Lang, and John will be one of our guests a bit later in this series, and it essentially networks Kiwi professionals working in the climate space all over the world. It started in London, but it's now, I think, got 400 or 500 members. This book is a book with 23 chapters, each by different New Zealanders who are active in the space and appropriately giving very good perspectives on our situation in Aotearoa. Kiwis in Climate should be on every Kiwi's bookshelf, is what I said in Climate Matters. Okay, skipping on. The Minister of Finance earns herself a goon gong. Nicola Willis has run the finances of a government that has negated or damaged almost every people positive and climate positive policy imaginable. Think of social cohesion, independence of the judiciary, research, climate science, and so on. Yet on budget day, she would have us believe her when she says, and I'm quoting, "It's my responsibility to be careful and prudent how to protect New Zealand's future." Minister, you've earned yourself a goon gong. Very briefly, we're running out of time. We'll give a link to the Climate Change Commission's page where they have their national climate change risk assessment with links to all sorts of documents. Here's one quick quote. "The most significant risks are the climate-related risk areas where focused action in governments in next adaptation plan can make the biggest difference." That plan is due May 2028, but we don't need to wait that long for the Climate Change Commission's assessment of the effectiveness of the last adaptation plan, due in just about 3 months. And we'll finish now with a hot tip for a cooler planet. It's a great hot tip. It's very easy, free, and here's what it is. Give way to buses whenever you can. If you're driving, And it's one of the simplest climate actions you can take. Letting buses out or letting them turn helps them run efficiently, which then means that everyone on the bus gets there quicker. But then the flow-on effects are the buses become more attractive. That encourages more people out of cars and into buses, and that leaves the rest of the traffic flowing even more smoothly with lower costs, saved time, lower emissions, and easier parking. How cool is that? And before I go, I just want to give a plug for the next two interviews. Next week, we will have Dr. Christina Hood, is well known as internationally as a respected climate policy expert. And then that will be followed by an interview with Nathan Surendran, who is an energy expert and has some very insightful things to say about energy and the economy. Thank you so much for your company. I do hope I enjoy it again next week. And as always, kia kaha for the climate. As you know, you're listening to Fresh FM, the top of the South's community access radio station. Fresh FM broadcasts in Blenheim on 88.9, to Eastern Golden Bay on 95.0, to the Nelson CBD on 107.2, and across the Nelson Tasman region on 104.8. It's also streamed to the planet on freshfm.co.nz, and podcasts of Climate Matters and other locally produced shows are available through freshfm.co.nz.
The podcast you just listened to was a live recording of a radio show, first broadcast by Fresh FM, with support from New Zealand On Air. Fresh FM is a community access media station based in Te Tauihu, the top of the South Island, New Zealand. The funding of Access Media makes these podcasts possible. To find similar programs by other community media stations, go online to accessmedia.nz. If you or your group would like to know more about how you can have a program on our station, please contact us. Visit our website, freshfm.co.nz, for our contact details.